All right. Welcome back. Avery Adventures Podcast number 55 with Jim Carr.
How are you doing?
Jim, a lot of people, obviously, Jim's been pretty quiet and to himself. He's a humble guy, so a lot of people out there won't know him. If you've ever bought a scouting package for We Scout for You, chances are Jimbo is the guy you've talked to. You come from a line of like 50 siblings.
Yeah, well, there's nine of us boys in my family, two girls.
So it was a rough upbringing?
Yeah. So we went a little while without no electricity or running water.
A lot of fighting.
Yeah, lots of that.
So how did you get into hunting? Was your dad a hunter? Did you just learn that skill from him? Or,
you know, we grew up in the mountains. We never really weren't a lot into the big game hunting, but I was addicted to the mountains. Even as a kid I'd spend nights outside hiking around. When I got a chance to start, I went when I was younger. My aunt, she did a lot of trails for the Forest Service, like in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness and the Frank Church, and I'd spend, you know, weeks during the summer backpacking with her, you know, kind of just exploring.
Oh, that's cool.
And I just, you know, I love looking for animals. And then once my uncle, actually, he took me on a backcountry hunt, and it was like back in the Selway, and it was love at first sight. I was addicted immediately. I started to think that's all, you know, figure out how I could figure those elk out and those muleys out, you know, kind of just, even though it was, you know, it was hard hunting in comparison to a lot of other areas, it was just the challenge there. It just captivated me. Just wanted, every time, you know, I would go back, I would, even when I was at home, I'd be thinking, what can I do better to figure these animals out? It was a challenge more than anything.
So you've ended up turning the scouting thing into just spending a little bit more times in the woods.
Yeah. And actually what happened, I kind of, not addictive personality, but not into substances, but to doing certain things. I used to be in football a lot. And when I got into hunting, it went from like 0 to 100 immediately, you know, trying to, you know, figure it all out. And when I didn't have, you know, when I was younger, I didn't have responsibilities. We'd do a lot of, I was a drywall hanger. And so we'd go bid jobs. I'd bid jobs around wherever, you know, Sun Valley, wherever it was mountains around. My brother had a place in town, but I would probably spend literally, you know, 100, 250 nights a year, mm-hmm. you know, out. And I'd go to work, go scout in the morning before work. I'll hike, be up on a ridge or something, hike down, do a morning scout, go down to work, and then be back somewhere else that evening. Just kind of, you know, it was all I thought about for quite a while there. Mm-hmm.
Addictive is not something I don't, it's past it. It's like obsessive.
Yeah, I would say obsessive.
I love hunting, and I love to be around people to hunt. I don't think I've ever met somebody as obsessive about hunting as you, which is a great thing. Maybe not to my wife or your wife, but to me.
Yeah, definitely not to my wife. You know, and whenever I got into the We Scout, what it really started, it was...
Before you get there, tell us how you met Robbie and how that whole thing started with getting into that scouting for pay, basically.
Yeah, so what happened was I wound up getting married, and then all of a sudden I realized really quickly that it's not acceptable that I'm just gone all the time. And you do spend, when you have a home base, you got to be all the time. You spend a lot of money to travel around and go scout in the time. So I was thinking, you know, I remember how much I would love to have like a scouting business where I got paid to scout to mm-hmm. cover my gas. Cause I remember whenever Jenny seen how much my gas bills were just going to work. And then I'd be driving freaking 3 hours after work every day. You know, I was working out of town on a construction job, pretty quickly got called out on me. So anyways, I wind up talking to, I seen the We Scout for You thing ad in the paper regulations a few times.
What year was this?
We must have been 2008, 2007.
In that time frame?
Yeah, right in there. Right when my first daughter was born. So I seen that, and I was thinking about doing the same thing. I wanted to start a scouting business, you mm-hmm. know, it was kind of already my thought. And I was never good with a computer or anything, so I just figured I'd call Robbie. So I called Robbie, just out of the blue.
You know, Robbie's not good with a computer either, right?
It's like called him out of the blue. We just started talking. We had a lot to talk about. Gave me a little bit of test, like start talking about an area, and he would talk about an area, and it was, you know, I could think he could tell that very quickly that I already had been there and knew it pretty well. It wasn't like I was just, you know, he tested me out. It wasn't like, oh, hey, you can come work for me. It was kind of he gave me a test, you know, and freaking, it was right off, you know, get me a reason. And my wife, Jenny, was okay with it because he got paid, you know, covered the gas.
Yeah, right,
exactly.
You know? And so that was what started the whole deal.
We started Rockslide in 2012, and Rob didn't get into Rockslide until around 2014-ish. But he kept talking about this Jim Carr guy. No, he kept basically saying he knows this stuff, he knows where this is, knows where that is. So I happened to call Jim. I don't even remember what the reasoning was, but I called you about something. a unit. He said, talk to Jim about it. So I called him up, and instantly I knew Jim was a man of his word, because there was just things that you don't know unless you've actually put boots on the ground. And nowadays I'll send Jim a picture or a video, and he is like an encyclopedia. He'll tell me exactly where that unit is. So he's the guy that you don't want to post skylines or backgrounds in Idaho, because he's going to know exactly where it is. So Jim, on the scouting thing, talk to me like how it works for the flow.
Whenever they contact me, I'm gonna first talk to them and try to figure out what they're actually looking for. You know, I want to try to get a good feel of, you know, if they're at, a lot of them are non-residents, and you want to get a feel if, you know, they got, what kind of skills they have. You know, you can't just send everybody to the hardest place to get to, you know, I've learned that.
A lot of people don't really know what they're getting into, so they might overestimate themselves. Like, how do you break that down and figure out really if their skill level is what they think it is, or... Because you want them, obviously, to be successful.
That's one thing I've learned over the years of getting better at, is trying to figure, you know, ask them questions about where they've hunted before, what kind of shape they are. And here in Idaho and Montana, a lot of people, you know, back east, they say, oh, I can go 5 or 6 miles, you know, but you want to figure out what kind of ability they have to go 5 or 6 miles, because Idaho is not flat 5 or 6 miles anywhere. Five or six miles in Idaho is a long way.
Yeah, I will throw this on Jim. If he tells you a time frame, just double it.
Double it? triple it.
Jim is he is an in-shape individual, and he doesn't – I sometimes don't think he's human.
You're like Terminator. Yeah, like
I followed him around a lot. And I've packed out some loads with him. And if he did your scouting package, A, the animals are there. He's telling you the truth, but you better be in shape. And if you're not, you better double all of his time frame. Jim is, I've hunted with lots of people. I don't think there's too many people that are going to stay with Jim Carr.
Well, I remember on my first elk hunt, there were some spots that Jim had recommended. And I was like, oh, hell no. Nope, we're not doing that. We're not going to where Jim says, because A, I'll never make it there. B, we'll be divorced by the time we get there. Like, we're not doing it.
If you're not with my wife, take care
of the same problems with your wife.
Like, you take her in some trouble.
Oh, I, you know, I
this
can
imagine. Real easy.
So once they pay for that process, what's involved? What do you give them?
Okay, so I'm going to go, you know, first I'm going to determine where they want to go, where, mm-hmm. you know, what's going to be acceptable. And that's the key part, in my opinion, because, you know, I want them to be not over, you know, overthink it. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to, when we come up with an area they want to hunt, they might already have an exact spot they want to go to. I've had a few people that had cabins rented or something where they mm-hmm. wanted to hunt from one spot. That makes it a little harder. You know, I got to, you know, can't make an area be great, you know, if it's not great.
Right.
But usually I'll recommend a spot, you know, and I'm not overlapping anybody, so it's not like I'm sending anybody right. the same spot, but I'll recommend what I think will work for them the best, and then come up to agreement, you know, where they want to hunt, and then I'm going to go scout that area the best I can, you know, find the animals, trying to find, you know, any, you know, the sign where they need to camp at, find mm-hmm. places to camp and water holes and whatnot, access into the area. And sometimes, you know, it's a little bit of a, there's some projection going on too, because, you know, if they're hunting later in the fall, you got to, I'm going to try to give them some past information too on the area. Like, okay, I know the elk, if they get a little bit of snow, they're going to move down and kind of down in, the, you know, here, if I know that area, you know, that time mm-hmm. of the year. I'm going to do a lot of, I'm going to give them, you know, the National Forest map and, you know, with corresponding spots. But a lot of the information I like to do on Google Earth, it's been a great tool for me, you know, be able to draw pin marks and routes into area and then send them yeah. to them. And then we can look it over together, and we'll spend a lot of time on the phone, you know, making sure they know what they're getting into, where they're going. And what they're looking at for, you know?
Yeah, Jim says he's not a computer guy, but he has showed me several things that I didn't know existed on Google Earth.
Yeah, when I first started the scouting thing, I didn't know anything about Google Earth. And when I scouted Idaho when I was younger, it was looking at maps and trial and error, all foot. You know, you get on your foot, you go hike to area, you go hiking mm-hmm. 10 miles, and all of a sudden you find out you're just in this thick, dense, you know, forest. It was a lot of trial and error. You kind of figure out what works and what doesn't work as far as what's game country, what's not. And then Google Earth, you know, just helps you with that, especially if you already know the area with boots on the ground. You can't just go look at Google Earth and pick an area and go in there and be a lot different than you think. But it's a great tool, narrowing things down and finding the best ways to get into area. Google Earth, you know, every area, I kind of found out that there's a lot of different areas, you know, in Idaho and other places. And you got to... you know, using Google Earth is great in conjunction. You like, you'll look at, you know, you get to one area and you could look, it could look great on Google Earth. And so you kind of determine, but you get in that area and you find out what habitat the game's actually using. And then you look at Google Earth when you get done with your scouting trip mm-hmm. and all of a sudden things will mean a whole different, you know, it'll mean different things to you. You'll be able to mm-hmm. see, okay, this is where they're actually using. But you can't just take that and go to a whole different area, you know, if you've never been there before and like, oh yeah, this is where the game looks like they're going to be, you know. I bet that's, you know, that can fail.
And she lies to you.
Oh yeah, definitely. You, she lies to you. Some places up here in North Idaho look like they're wide open. You get in here, it's like, yes. Freaking, what the heck, yes, is this jungle?
That, like, for instance, the particular place we hunted up north, it just looks more open.
Yeah.
And you get in there and those trees are way taller, the brush is way thicker, and the mountain, the curve on the mountain is just way different than it looks, what you think it will be in your head when you're looking at Google Earth.
Yeah. Well, and how often do they update that?
It could be anywhere from, it can be 3 years out, 4 years out. There's a lot of, like, for instance, the burns.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of burns that aren't even on there that were back in 2015.
So on that, so you get with them, and then afterwards, do they get back to you and say, yeah, I was successful, or man, you sucked, you didn't even put me on any elk or deer or whatever?
Yeah, no, that's one of the things I always try to do. And a lot of times, they're actually calling me, you know, I'm calling them right before their hunt and telling them what the weather's like, and then they'll call me. I've had guys call me every day during the hunt. And sometimes it's like, why are you calling me at 7 a.m. and you're not up on the ridge? You know,
right.
I've had that many times. I'm like, and one thing I try to stress to all the guys I scout for, and this is one thing that's important. It's one thing about being in an area hunting, and this is why you got to be in shape and you got to have a plan. You got to be able to, you know, get to where you want to go. You got to be there at first light. You got to be there at last light. It's not hiking up to the area and getting there and saying, oh, I've seen the area. I didn't see any animals. I turned around and went back. I've seen that a lot. That's, you know, that's probably one of the biggest keys is people actually hunting the actual area. Being in the general vicinity, you know, being on the mountain doesn't mean anything. There's specific habitats on a mountain or wherever you're hunting at that is where you need to be, and you need to be there in the first couple hours and the last couple hours.
You need to be hiking to the spot when it's still dark. So when the sun starts to come up, you're already in the spot you need to be at. That's what a lot of people don't get.
It seems so simple, but it's a... No, like this year, for instance, the guy that walked up after you shot that bull.
Yeah.
He's like, I guess you guys beat me here, you know, and he said, I started walking at daylight. Well, you can't start walking at daylight.
No, we like, it was pitch dark when we were still getting to our, I mean, when we were getting to our spot, it was still dark. And
yeah, we were there a good hour before it was daylight.
So
it's, and I'm not saying we're better. That was just, you got to put in the work.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody likes to get up. I mean, some people probably like to get up early. We don't like to get up early. Mm-mm. So it's not like it's a good time, but I mean, you know, so what do you say to these people at 7 a.m. when they call you? Do you say, why are you calling me right now when you should be up on a ridge not speaking?
I do. To me, I tell them, you know, I try to tell them before the hunt, I stress a lot of areas. You got to be able to know your optics and use your binoculars to your advantage. Because I've had a few people go to areas that are just loaded, but you got to be able to glass them up. And I've had them go there and not see anything. And I went back and it was like, man, how can you not see anything, you know? But the main thing, you know, I tell them, you got to be where you need to be at first light and last light. And Ryan knows this, man, if I don't get to an area before it's dark, I'm already feeling depressed. You know, like, I mean, before it's light, you know, if I'm late, it's like, man, I'm burning my the first 30 minutes are the best. And, you know, it goes so on. So,
I've never heard Jim really get excited and cuss very much. But that day we were deer hunting with your brother and we woke up late.
Jim
went off on a little tirade for about a minute and a half about being late. It was pretty awesome. But you got to be there before the light, and you got to stay there till after light. Whether you have to start early hiking in the dark or you have to camp, you know, backpack in and stay somewhere nearby it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we also go over is, you know, what they, if they get capable of spiking out.
Yeah.
You know, that's the main ingredient there is being actual hunting spot. For, you know, prime time.
So do you have a bunch of guys that, I mean, what is your experience level overall? Do you feel like the people that come to you, the ones that go hunting once a year or that they just are in a different area, but they're experienced hunters? What do you think?
I get them all over the place. I get guys that they've hunted from tree stands and, you know, back east, and they are not ready for, you know, Western big game. You know, and for getting, you know, maybe ranch hunts, but, you know, getting backcountry do-it-yourself hunts, that's what I specialize in. And that's kind of, you know, you get guys that don't really have a clue. I've had guys that wanted me to, you know, Western hunting's big country. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not just looking at an acre. I've had guys kind of like want me to like give them directions in like, you know, yards. Like, after I go from point A, where do, like they're looking, they have this small they're used to hunting like, you know, woodlots or something, sure. You know?
Yeah.
So they're kind of thinking in small terms. Well, I'm telling them you got to be able to look at country.
Like miles instead of yards. Yeah,
it's not small. You're thinking too small for Western. We don't have that kind of density where you can just go and go hunt 10 acres and be successful.
So do they ever like hit you up for gear lists of things?
Yeah, I get hit up for gear lists. And then guys that are successful are guys, you know, there's quite a few guys that are successful. And I've had a lot of repeat customers that are very successful wherever I have sent them. But they, you know what they do? They get there early. They don't have no problem backpacking in, or they don't have no problem being at first light, you know, hiking, you know, getting there early and being, you know, hunting hard. That's the biggest difference I'd say between one person to the next.
It's the effort. There's only so much you can do for them. They have to put in the effort. All you're telling them is, yep, I've been there and I've seen animals there. And then from then they have to hunt. I mean, it's still, you can't just show up.
He goes, I mean, some people just don't know things. I mean, about hunting. So, I mean, before I started hunting, I wouldn't really think to put two and two together and make sure that I got up to a certain spot before light. Mm-hmm. You know, like I just, if you don't know things, you don't know them. So, I mean, along with, you know, those recommendations that this is what you're going to have to do. I mean,
yeah. And sometimes I'm sure you have to qualify that buyer, like you were saying before, where like Tanya said, it's second nature to me and you, but for somebody that say is this is their first Western hunt or maybe their second or third, and the other one was with an outfitter and this one's not.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to be a different game for them, especially on public land.
Yeah. If you don't know animal behavior, you're not going to know these things to, you know.
Yeah. No, that's one thing my wife has been a help with is the way I, you know, communicate with some of these guys. Sometimes I've communicated like, it's obvious, you know, going up the ridge and, you know, some things are too, you know, beans are so obvious to people like us that do it a lot, you know, and then a lot of those guys, you know, they are stumped out of the gate, you know, so
yeah,
she has told me I need to tone my language down in the way that they can, you know, think smaller and try to.
Acronyms, but you guys have terminology most people don't understand. I got into a huge argument with Ryan one day over breaking a trigger at the range. I'm like, what does that even mean? I don't even understand. And he's like, everybody knows what that means. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. So I don't really give a shit what anybody else knows because I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the terminology that is so second nature to you guys.
Yeah, and that's why Tanya is really good for this podcast because I look at things totally different than she does. And we do argue about it as you and Jenny argue about stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, if you don't know, I mean, it's just like, you know, being in the medical field or the law field is terminology.
Or military.
Military. If you don't know, and it's not that you're stupid, you just don't, you don't have that experience.
That was blatantly obvious when my son came home and he was throwing around military jargon that I hadn't heard in a long time. And I was like, oh, the land of the acronym.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was in a different country all of a sudden with Ryan and Lane speaking back and forth, all these military acronyms. So what is your price point for We Scout for you?
Okay. Yeah. So we charge $8.95 for a full scouting package. And that includes the, you know, the map, Google Earth points and me talking. That's where I go spend whatever it takes to find a good spot for somebody. You know, that's what that's for. And then we have an informational package, which is more past information, but it actually can be, you know, very, you know, every bit is good because it's information that I'm not, you know, that I've been to in areas in the past and kind of have a good familiar, you know, with it. And sometimes some areas that are migration areas, you know, that might be all it takes, you know.
Well, explain that a little bit. Past information, like, is this an area you were that at like 5 years ago or?
Well, it could be an area I was at this year or it could be last year, you know, areas that I'm familiar with. If I do an informational package, it's something that I'm pretty confident in. You know, they're going to have an opportunity to be on game.
And how much is that one?
It's $350.
What would you just, I know you, everybody doesn't probably call you back, but what's your success rate on these packages?
It's hard to gauge. Sometimes like the year before last, it seemed like I had like a dozen really guys that really wanted to get after elk and a good portion, I think eight of them, you know, there were more than eight elk, but eight of them were pretty, it had pretty good hunts. And I had one guy where they didn't even make it. They wanted a high backpack in and they never even made it 2 miles. And they said, oh, this country's too much for us. And then, you know, I've had a few of those, you know, you always get a couple of those guys. Yeah. And then
call you up and say, what the hell? Where'd you send me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 8 out of 12, that's good. That's like what, 75% or something?
Every year is not like that. You know, I've had it just comes and goes. It just depends on who you get and where they want to go. You know, I've had some guys that want to just go hunt, you know, easy area, you know, so I'm going to scout easy area by, you know, with a rifle for an elk in a general unit.
They'd and like it, you to maybe just try tie one up to a tree and just walk up to it and shoot
within
it
within a half mile of their floor. That's a hard thing to do on public land. You know, you could get lucky,
but
there's another, you know, where they were going was they had a cabin rented and there was, you know, people driving around all over the place. So, you know, that's kind of a, I feel that it, you know, gives, you know, somebody that doesn't have experience here in Idaho or don't know what, where they're going, I feel it gives them a good chance to be in game and cut down on their scouting time. Cause you know, you can go to an area and start hunting. And you could spend a week just learning where you need to hunt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? Absolutely.
And some of those guys, it's just hard if they're a flatlander, never been to the Rockies.
Yeah. And I'm learning every day. Every time I'm out in the mountains, I think I learn something new, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's never what keeps you guys safer.
And that's one way we can all, you know, everybody can improve their hunting skills. And as far as learning country is, you know, don't get in that mindset that I already know everything. I'm good at it. I got my spot down. You always should be on the lookout for new country or new, you know, something better. Cause it just, that's probably why I like it. If I had one spot that I could go and just be 100% successful and I didn't go look anything else and it was already in the bag, maybe the lure wouldn't be there for me. You know, I never know what's around the next corner and I love that. That's why I love scouting, you know?
Yeah. I've never seen a person that glasses so much. I think I glass a lot. But Jim is tenfolds. We lately went on a cow hunt. His daughter had a tag. I had a tag, and our buddy Justin had a tag. And we were already done cutting up meat. And Jim, you look at Jim, and he's glassing. He's glassing for elk, glassing for animals.
Well, that's something you should talk about because a lot of people, they'll scan an area and then be like, nope, nothing's here. Get up, move to another area. But you don't do that. You stay. What's your like general rule of how long you'll stay in glass in an area before you move to a different location?
Well, it all depends on the country. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many angles from one spot you can see, and just by moving a few feet, you get another angle, and you'd be surprised. You know how there'd be bedded elk in one spot, and you could have looked over that spot a few times, and all of a sudden, oh shoot, one just popped up, and then there's 100 elk right there.
Yeah,
we learned that lesson hunting elk down south with those guys that came in and.
Yeah, well, anywhere down south, you look and it look in, and then all of a sudden they would just pop up, and I was just like, oh my gosh, oh, they're just, look, they weren't there a second ago. And that was, to me, one of the most, it's exciting because, it's like you kind of get addicted to like continuing to look because you want to keep finding them. So I feel kind of sad for people that don't take the time to stay a while and keep glassing because they're missing all of that. That's like what hooks you.
Yeah, and Jim's right on moving 10 feet can give you a totally different angle on stuff.
Yeah, so usually if I'm glassing in a spot, it's going to be, you know, might be a couple hundred, you know, it might be a couple hundred yards or more, whatever it takes to hit new angles, and I'll just be working, I'll leave my bag sit in one place, and I'll just work different angles, and those angles are what really gives you, you know, whole different perspectives.
So what do you use for glassing? Do you use a spotting scope? Do you use binos on a tripod? Like, what's your system?
I use binos on a tripod. And then and if I'm in an area that I'm having a hard time picking out game for some reason, like I'm just not maybe taking the time, you know, every area can be different as far as what it takes to find animals. So especially when you're in new country, you know, I'll use my binoculars, kind of scan at first and then go in there and start trying to hit, you know, a little deeper and trying to pick out stuff. And if I'm having a hard time, and maybe it's sometimes it's just me, I'm going too fast. You know, you're not slowing down. You got to, like I said, each area kind of has its formula on what it takes to find them. And sometimes if I'm having a hard time, what I'll do is I'll just go to the spotter and I'll just really pick it apart. And then all of a sudden when I start finding animals with the spotter, then I'm starting to get confidence. I have to have confidence where I'm glassing, you know. Mm-hmm. And you start getting lower to confidence. Okay, I'm seeing them here and here and here. And this is what they're looking like right now. So then I'll go back to my binoculars, and then I'll usually have more success.
So when you say that, do you like break it up like the hillside into like a grid pattern or
breaking it apart? Is, you know, I guess I'm not. I'm kind of all over the place a little bit, but I'm looking for certain habitats that, you know, I'll scan everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll scan everything multiple times. You know, easy, real, you know, quick scans, and that's when I'll pick something up moving. But once I've determined where I'm seeing animals at, I will focus on those areas, you know, with the hard glassing. I'm not going to, and I'll scan everything else. And that sometimes when you're scanning, you find something and then you find a whole different area that you want to glass. But I focus my hard glassing on those high potential areas for spotting.
That look elky.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And elky can be, that can be changed.
I like that terminology.
One of my favorite elk areas that I hunted for a long time and scouted a lot is I knew exactly where I was finding animals at all the time. And it's a giant area. I went down to some other country and I was like traveling and I noticed some guys glassing. They're glassing up in this country that you would not think had elk. And I looked at it a few times and I'd never seen an elk. But it was the fact that I seen them glassing there made me look. And once I found a couple elk there, it just totally changed the perspective on that whole area. Mm. Now I'm finding elk in this habitat. And when I never seen it, I never seen them before. And it turned out to be, I think I seen 200 elk but you were looking at country that you never even, never thought of. It didn't look elky and nobody else would think it was elky too. And then I wound up having success there and had a couple, another friend that had success there. And he wound up telling his buddy, his cousins about the area. They had success in the other archery hunting in the other part of the unit. And anyways, he had told him about it. And then he kind of said, he told me he regretted telling him about it. Well, anyways, they had spent 3 days down there. And I just killed an elk. And I was coming out. My buddy, he was coming to meet me. And his cousin just happened to drive up. Oh, hey, how's it going? They said, man, we're going back to the other country. We've been looking for 3 days and we seen one cow. And we just looked at each other because we were looking, where we had met. Mm-hmm. I think we'd seen 15 bulls.
From where we're at. It's just, say a word.
You just got to get that confidence of what you're looking at and, where you're finding them at. Because you can just, if you just scan real quick, you can go to this, there's one point in particular. You can get there and you can glass real quick and you might not see an elk. But if you were to stay there for the whole evening, you can have a phenomenal glassing day with all kinds of bulls and stuff. But it takes more than just, quick look. Oh, it doesn't look elky. Move on.
So don't just dismiss an area because you don't think there's going to be elk there. It's not elky enough. But I mean, that's a good point, though, because everybody, we say that all the time. Oh, that's not going to be an area that they'll be. Or, you kind of get locked in these mindsets of where they are going to be and where they aren't going to be based on the, surroundings.
And one of the ways I scout a lot of new areas, not totally new, but means I'm scouting so many different country, I don't overlap anybody. I'm always looking for a new country and at new country. And one of the times I like to scout, a very underrated time to scout, is early in the summer, like late June, early July, when it's super green.
And is that when you trick your family on going on camping
trips?
Yeah,
exactly. But what happens is the animals seem like they're feeding more. And I can move around, not necessarily have to get into that real, where you're picking country apart. But I can go around and I can just scan and I'll find a lot more animals than you would a month later, say, where you have to sit down and pick them apart. So now I can determine, okay, I know animals are using this country, and this country. So now when I go back, I know where I'm looking.
Right.
Rather than just go in there and see, you can get tunnel vision just sitting in one spot. Like we're talking, that's the way you need to glass. But if you go sit in one spot, you got to have confidence that there's animals there. And if you only get where you don't scout that much, or you only get where you only have one spot, you might be overlooking a whole lot of country. So I like to, part of my scouting is just covering country and finding out where they're at first. And then that's when I'll get down in there. Once I know where they're hanging out at, seems like you learn a little bit more country doing that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now that makes sense.
One of the things that's never mentioned that you're paying for with a scouting service, like all I can say is we scout for you. I really don't know any other scouting services, is you're paying for Jim and Robbie's gut feeling of hunting, a combined of 80 years. And a gut, and to me, your gut feeling after you hunt for a while, you have a spot where you should in your mind or your gut feeling is there should be something here and I'm going to find it. And that's something that a guy that's just starting hunting, or he can't live in the West like you guys do, or like I do, they don't have that gut feeling of where something's going to be. And you might stay that extra 5 or 10 minutes to see that animal. And that's what when you go to the scouting service, that's what you're buying, in my opinion.
You're buying the experience, Yep.
They know where to put you. They know an area to put you. And I don't think that's very underrated.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And that's one of the things I was thinking. And that's one of the things whenever I'm talking to hunters, that's what I try to convey to them. I'm putting them in a spot that if I was hunting there, that's where I would want to hunt. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you can't just go there and scout it a couple of days and necessarily you're not going to find all the animals in summertime. Sometimes it's hot and animals aren't out feeding like they are. So it's kind of a gut feeling too, where I would go hunt. I'm not going to, where I'd hunt. And you also spend a lot of time just looking for sign and tracks and whatnot during the day. And that's kind of where you get your determination, where you're going to glass spend your time glassing at. You know, if I find a whole bunch of sign in one area, you know, you might not see them because they might only be out that last 30 minutes in the hot summer. And, but if you find a bunch of elk tracks or deer tracks in an area that you, or buck tracks and beds and stuff, then you know that's okay. That's probably an area that you might want to spend some time looking.
Yeah. So that's, to me, it's your, what you're buying is a cheat code.
Yeah. Everybody's always looking for the cheat code. And, you know, Rock Slide, we see that question all the time. Like, hey, you know what, you know, people are always trying to find a way to, the infamous thing I always hear is, well, I don't have a lot of time. Basically they're trying to figure out a way to get it done faster than, you know, anybody else, or not necessarily anybody else, but just how can they get it done in the least amount of time? Well, that's how you get it done in the least amount of time. You have Jim do all the work for you, basically.
Yeah, and people say, I always laugh when they say they don't have time. Jim works another full-time job and has four daughters. Four daughters under the age of 11.
So is there just these two packages, Jim, before we go away?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we offer. Yeah, definitely have a lot on my plate as far as that goes. I'm gone for 2 weeks of time away from the family, and it's definitely cut down on my hunting a lot. You know, I'm spending the summer scouting, and then when it comes down to hunting season, you know, lately, you know, having all the family, you know, the four daughters and my wife and everything is, you know, definitely, I'm on call, you know, I got responsibility, so I don't get to hunt as much as I would like to. A lot of times I'll find a lot of good animals and they never get to go back after them.
Yeah. And you have young hunters coming up. So that's even cutting into your hunting time, which is great, but
super excited.
Some people think that's great. Some people would not. Jim, you're a good dad. So you think that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. I was so excited to take my daughter Annabelle elk hunting this year.
So Annabelle, I have to explain how this happened. Annabelle turned 10 last year and she, in February, she went out and she shot a cow elk. Then she drew a controlled hunt, and she, in October she shot a bull elk.
Yep.
And then we went out last week, and she shot a cow elk. So in her 10th year of life, she shot 3 elk in a calendar year.
Yep.
Some people haven't shot 3 elk their whole life, been chasing them for years, so I just find that hilarious.
Yeah, no, I seen that, you know, I knew she was going to turn 10 on, she turned 10 on January 27th, and she had her hunting license already, and I'm like, so what hunts can I put in her? That was last year, you know, the only hunt that she could have was after she turned 10, you have to be 10, so there was a hunt that went until February, so I put her in for that hunt, and I put her in for that hunt again this year, so it was kind of, by the time she was 11, she already had 3 down.
And people will email me and say, how is this possible? Well, you can use your grandparents' tag and transfer it to your grandkids.
Yep.
And I remember some of those were your grandparents', your grandparents' tags.
This last cow tag was
3 elk in 1 year. That just amazes me. That could be some kind of a record for a 10-year-old girl.
So your other daughters, elk. Do you think all of them will hunt? Or, I mean, obviously Julia is a baby still, but don't know about her.
Yeah, my next one in line, she just turned 9, so she has to wait one more year, and she is all over. She is like, she's already trash talking her sister. Like, she's going to beat her. She wants to beat her bad.
Oh, hey, it's going to get ugly when it comes to transferring tags with the grandparents. Kids are going to go to? Like, they might have to, like, draw numbers or something, because it's going to get a little tense at your house.
I'm excited about taking them both again. I'm ready to take Annabelle on I want to get her on a backpack hunt again, and she did great. No problems with the hiking part. So.
Yeah, you guys were in for her bull tag like 5 or 6 miles, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't want to be left alone, so she did stay behind. She didn't even slow me down.
So what have you – I mean, we complain all the time about like women's gear, but that's – we have a whole bunch of options compared to what kids have. What have you been doing? Like, what is she using to keep her warm? Do you have trouble finding things for her to keep her warm?
Yeah, I had trouble, especially I learned a lot on my, on her first hunt. It was cold. It was around 3 degrees that last February. I had her wear some snow boots because it was cold. You know, we hiked, we actually hiked a lot further than I had planned on her going, and she wound up getting her whole back, both of her ankles were all just torn off with blisters. I thought she was going to be done, but she went out the next day with more like a tennis shoe boot. So she just took that cold and she did pretty good. I have not been able to find the great gear. You know, she's growing, so I didn't want to go out and, you know, spend a ton of money.
That's a hard thing,
for something that's going to be out of pretty quick. But I did, you know, got her a good, decent jacket, you know, keep her warm and keep her dry. That's the main deal, is keeping her dry.
Well, I mean, Sitka is the only company that I know that has an actual kids line. Have you tried any of their stuff for the youth? Or
I haven't
is
yet.
It that she's just, I mean, she's probably growing at such a quick rate at the age she is. It's hard to find something that's going to fit her.
I honestly haven't, but it's something I need to look into, yeah. You know, because that's definitely my the weak point. I need to get her some better gear for.
Well, and you can you can use it for years because you have three coming behind her.
Right. Yeah. That is a good point. I mean, that's nice. You don't just have like one kid that you are going to have to keep outfitting and buying new stuff for every single year. You know, you'll hopefully be able to pass it on. And Sitka actually makes a really good product, so you know it's going to last. It's not going to fall apart from year to year. But yeah, that's a challenging thing when you have multiple family members. It gets really spendy.
Yeah. And having a backpack for her because they are small stature.
Yeah, that's something I need to work on there is getting her outfit a little bit better.
It's kind of switching gears. If a guy isn't going to go through the Wee Scout for you, do you have any tips for him for e-scouting online or actually when he comes out here if he does do any scouting in the summer?
Yeah, I'd say, first of all, get to know your area before, you know, if you narrow down where you're thinking of going. You want to make sure you get the national forest maps that have shoulder roads and you know whatnot, so you actually can look at a big picture of that area rather than get, you know, if you just look at a screen on your phone or something, you know, you're going to get a little tunnel vision. You want to be able to look at a big picture, look at your public access points, and then you start to use Google Earth but try to correlate it with where you can think you can hike, you know, and using the Google Earth as far as like. I would put the routes on there so you can see what the angles of the hills are, just how steep they are, you know, because you can just look at Google Earth real quick and then think you're going to hike up a ridge and then you go up there and it's a 60-degree angle the whole way very easily.
She lies to you.
And I'd recommend if you're going to a new area and you get the chance to scout it is go early in the year when, you know, the game's out a little bit more plentiful. They seem like they kind of have that. They're out a little longer. Mm-hmm. They're out more consistent, you know, trying to get beefed up for, you know, the next winter, you know, when it's real green, that first green up, you know, gives you an idea of what you're, you know, where the animals are going to be at.
Is there any certain thing to look for? Do you look for, you know, like seeps, water, feeding grounds, burns? Is there any particular thing you're looking for when you decide what place to scout?
Yeah. All the above, you know, if it's a dry area, one thing's when I'm out covering country during the day, it's just as important as evening and morning scouting during the summer is you want to scout. First thing you want to do when you're scouting that area, look at all your access points, whether it be on the internet or if you're in the area. You want to look at your access points and you want to look at any additional access points that you overlook because, you know, you can hike into an area. You can think, oh, I'm going to go up this. This looks like a good spot to go into. And there could be a four-wheeler trail you didn't even think about coming up the backside and you get there in opening morning and there's 10 people on a four-wheeler up there. And that can happen. That's stuff you want to avoid.
You said public access points. Will you be able to tell from the map which ones are like ATV accessible?
Yeah, you should be able to, and you want to get the travel plan maps. And then you just want to look on. You just want to go. When you're looking at Google Earth, one of the things I like to do is actually look and see if there's roads that maybe weren't on. You know, if you pick a spot, you want to look if there's roads. Mm-hmm. And if you actually go during the day when you're scouting, if you actually get to scout it, you want to go look for those roads. You know, you want to go look, drive around it. Everything that you can access from that seems accessible from a road around there, you want to see what's actually, if you see a little two track going up the road and there's a bunch of tracks going up there and it looks like people have been up there, there's a good chance people are going to be up there come hunting season. So you want to look for all your access points. And then during the day is when you want to go look for those water seeps. You want to look for in a dry area, you know, so later in the summer, you know, you get September, it's going to dry up even more and you get spots that just barely have any water and you get spots that are, you know, maybe look like they're going to endure that summer and it's a dry area. That spots, you know, you definitely want to focus on. I've had areas in the past I scouted that the game were spread out quite across and I wind up going there, you know, September and I've had it where there was nothing, but you went to a couple of the water holes that looked like they were going to last. They was just absolutely gold mine. Whereas everything else was dead. You know, you could look for a day and not see anything.
Do you think that the e-scouting and the scouting service have ruined hunting, like on the forums, everybody thinks that it's the end of the world.
Oh, have they ruined hunting?
Yeah.
No. Nope.
Have they ruined spots? There is no more honey holes. Do you believe in that theory?
Not at all. I see a lot more talk than I do. You know, I've seen a lot of areas that I've even seen people mention and people get on those internet forums and that area is just overrun with people. And that might be the case, But I don't really, you know, my goal when I get to areas is get back away from roads and stuff. And I've had a lot of areas that are just as the same they are today as they were before, even if they were mentioned. People think they drive around on a road and they see twice as many vehicles. It's not necessarily indicated that, you know, 5 miles in, there's anybody in there. For instance, 3 years ago, I did two packages for two different archery hunters. And then it was an area I scouted, and I was really impressed with the game numbers I seen where I mm-hmm. scouted in. And these guys were supposed backpack hunters. Mm-hmm. They were in great shape, and they wanted to get away from it. The area had been promoted by several people on the internet. It was a definitely upcoming fish and game, actually, very irritated me by recommending the area to a lot of people. They put it in the newspaper, you know, mm-hmm. so it was kind of like, crap, you know, I didn't like that. You know, I don't mind them giving information to people, right. but not, you know, if people ask.
Not
you
pinpoint seek information.
Seek, like, but not units.
Don't say, oh yeah, this unit has double the elk it had 5 years ago. Why don't you guys all come and hunt it? You know, but if somebody asks, you know, that, you know, they should right. be off to at least have some, the area, needless to say, had, you know, the hunting pressure had increased significantly. Mm-hmm. But so I scouted this area, and there's a trail that leads through the area in two different spots. A trail, and then there's a lot of basins that come off of these trails. There's a lot of country. You know, it was a big area. But, you know, both guys said the exact same thing. So one guy pulled up to his trailhead, and there's a lot of country in there. The one guy that said, he pulled up the trailhead, and he almost cussed me out by saying he's seen seven vehicles at the trailhead. And I'm like, and he's like, what do I do? I said, you go back there and hunt those basins. You're miles off the trail. You're not going to see anybody. And he wound up walking a little bit. He never even go up there. And he turned around and left. He didn't even call me back. And then the other guy, pretty much the same thing. He said there was six or seven at this trailhead. He didn't wind up hunting the area. And I wind up having, he whined a little bit. And I wind up giving him another spot, you know, kind of, because he was just complaining. He was like, mm-hmm. I ain't going to waste my time. I happened to be coming back home. And, coming back home, and I'm driving through the area. So I decided to go up there just the heck of it, see if, you know, what happened if, because I was kind of, I didn't ever seen that many people there in the bottom, mm-hmm. but there's so much country, and the country's big, you know, lots of different drainages and stuff and lots of different pockets. I wound up walking up 2 miles in the dark where I told him to go. And I wound up veering up and getting up into some basins where I had scouted for him. And I wind up never seeing another hunter that day. I seen a bull on the trail back where I crossed. I think I seen 16 bulls, and they're all bugling. Never seen another hunter. I got in on bulls. I didn't have an elk tag. I called in several bulls. It was a phenomenal day, and I was, this guy's a freaking moron. But, you know, it was like, you know, didn't even give it a chance, you know.
So did he call you after you gave him the second spot? Did you ever hear if he got anything?
No, he didn't really get back to me. You know, he was kind of, it was one of, you know, that's the kind of guys that definitely get one or two of those every year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was like he gave up before he even started. And I've seen it in a unit that everybody talks about. I'm not going to mention the unit. There's a couple units where a lot of people say the same thing as ruin. But I've been up there many times. And if you're driving around a road, you'll hear the same thing. Man, there's so many people here. It's just overcrowded. You shouldn't be on the road. You know,
yeah.
You don't get back in there 3 miles and you don't see anybody. You see a lot of right. animals. You
most
know?
People, most right. of those guys won't go back even 3 miles.
Well, when I'm on a ridge and I look down and I see all these people down the bottom, I don't see anybody around me. I'm like, this is good because everything's going to be over here where yeah. I'm at.
Right.
That happened to me and Tanya this year with her tag, and you've been in there. We actually did see people in there, and they kept telling us they didn't see anything.
Yeah, we saw three different groups of people that as they were coming out, were like, did you guys see anything? And all of them, only one of them said that they did.
Yep, the wolves had killed everything.
But everybody else, the wolves had killed everything.
And I went up the day before scouting, and I saw two bulls, and I saw probably 20 cows. And then the opening day, we seen, I don't know, 12 cows and mm-hmm. the bull, and she shot it. So you cannot right. listen to the
people.
Well,
it's not the easiest. I mean, it's not the easy way. I mean, we had to hike, I don't know about how far, a couple miles.
We hiked in about 4.5 and had to hike in about 2.5 more.
Yeah, so after we got to our base camp, which was 4.5 miles off the road, we mm-hmm. had to hike another 2-ish miles, which isn't real far, honestly.
No, and they said they didn't hear anything, and they only one had seen one bull. First night, maybe they didn't. I don't want to say they did or they didn't, but the first night I heard three different bulls bugling up on that ridge, and I physically seen two big bulls, not huge bulls, but two mature bulls. And it's like, what were they doing? And they may not hunt the same way as you. They may not know what they're looking for, or they may have just gotten unlucky. But most times when you talk to people and they're coming out, they're not going to tell you what you want to hear. So you might as well not even ask.
Well, and they were on horses, so I don't know if the way that they were hunting.
Yeah, that could have been a factor.
And I have no experience hunting on horses, so I don't know what their behavior is in relation to elk. If they scare them or they're not bothered by them, I have no idea. But that could have been a factor.
I had a group of three guys this year. I scouted area and seen a lot of deer. They were going mule deer hunting, and they wound up getting into the area. They got there that morning, and they seen a couple vehicles, and they were really worried and seen that, like a wall tent. And so they were really worried about people. And then they wind up having a couple people coming out. You know, this is right. They got there the day before the opener or the day of the opener, and they seen a couple people out, and they said, "Yeah, we've been out back there. We didn't see anything." And these guys call me all day. They probably call me six times that day, wanting to know where else they should go. And I said, "No, you need to stay right there. You need to go where I had found elk pretty close to the road, but mule deer. And then I had found some good pockets back in there with a lot of muleys. And it was a great spot. I said, you need to stay there." And then they kept telling me, they get another guy who was saying they hadn't seen nothing. And these guys were they were almost talked out of it. They were almost going to leave. What area can we go to? I told them to stick there, and they wind up all shooting their three biggest bucks, and they had a really great hunt on opening on the first day they hunted. But you know, they didn't want to stay. They had that itch to move because they heard bad information. Right. Somebody told them, "Oh, there ain't nothing in here." And so
goodness that you know, they did listen to your advice, because that's what they're paying you for. So I don't understand why people, I mean, I get it. They start hearing stuff and they don't, but they came to you because you had experience and knowledge. So they should have stuck with what you're saying instead of what the other people are saying that they don't know anything about.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't talk to anybody and get...
Well, they may have been lying, because how often do people say, "Hey, you guys seen anything?" Nope, haven't seen a dang thing.
I am guilty.
Yeah, I'll be there
all the time.
I mean, who wouldn't?
I haven't seen shit.
Everybody does. Everybody does, especially with another hunter.
Turn around and go home. There hasn't been an animal up there in 10 years.
One thing about hunting, this is probably, you know, after your physical ability and everything, is confidence. If you don't have confidence in the spot you go to, it's easy to not see anything. It's easy to talk yourself out of it. You don't look as hard as you know. Finding animals is not easy. Mm-hmm. And so if you go in there without that, like, "Oh, I'm not going to see anything," and the people have already talked you down and got you low, you know, you have a low expectation there. A lot of times, I mean, that's where it's gonna end.
Right.
You know, you start seeing game and it starts picking up, and you actually see a lot more game. Whereas if you don't not seeing it and you're not thinking you're going to see it, it can easily, you know, just that. Bad attitude on it can have a huge impact on your hunt.
Absolutely. Well, we, on my elk hunt, we heard from all those people, "Nope, haven't seen anything." But we had a friend that we did trust that pointed us out in that area. And he's like, "Once you get there, stay there, don't move." And obviously we ended up being successful, but you have to go with the people that you trust and not let yourself be swayed by strangers.
No, and it was, he had gave me good intel, Jim, about the same spot, you know, where we were, that you'd seen animals in there. He's got, and what I said before, I'll stand by your pain for your gut instinct on locations. And I can't overemphasize that enough. If you guys are going to pay for that scouting service, that's what you're buying. I don't care if Jim tells you it's the stupidest place on earth when you get there. I would hang around because you're probably going to see some animals.
Yeah. And honestly, that's such a fair price for what they're getting. I mean, how many hundreds of hours have you spent even looking at each location to, you know, and they may not have that kind of time or, you know, whatever. So it's an extremely fair price you guys charge, especially for how much you work to get that information.
Me being able to scout areas, probably finding big bucks and finding big bulls in my, you know, in the morning. I mean, it's such a rush for me. I get so excited about it. Just seeing a nice buck, even during the summer, you know, just.
Is there any spots in Idaho you don't know?
I know I've been most area, but you know, there's other areas I know less than other areas, you know. I know areas better than others. And spots are changing. After a few years, some areas might change a little bit, especially with, you know, certain things happen, fires. Places do change.
Yeah, burns and logging and the roads access from the burns, if they did fight the fire, that all makes a difference.
Let's talk about your gear. What optics are you using?
I use a Swarovski EELs, and then the Swarovski spotting scope was at that 20 by 60 by 65 millimeter. And these are older. I've had them each for about 9 years.
Yours is the STS.
Yeah.
Spotter.
Yeah, they're. I'm a little outdated. I don't know if I could get my wife to go for another one.
Jim, I'm hard on gear. Like, I think I'm extremely hard. Jim is the next level. I've seen, he had a pair of binoculars. I don't know how he could physically use them. Looked like he drug him behind his truck from Coeur d'Alene to Boise.
Yeah. But yeah, I have had to send him into Swarovski a few times to get the lenses redone.
Lenses redone. New coating.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like aluminum hang showing.
They're like,
they get used. I mean, when I'm out there with my binoculars, they are constantly be moved. I'll have a binocular case, but I mean, it's, I mean, yeah. I don't go 5 minutes. If I can see, and there ain't 5 minutes, I'm not.
I've had to pick him up off the ground and give him back to him a few times.
So what tripod are you using for?
I'm using the Slick 624 right now.
We can go on to a whole tangent about quality glass.
You gotta trust somebody on glass. You gotta know some, you know, people, look what people use in the field. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, what's, you gotta get, look at good reviews on that part, because you can't look at a store.
No.
You know, everything will be kind of close, you know?
Well, and everything feels all right and looks all right when you're only holding it for like a minute. But when you're holding it for hours and looking through it, you don't know the eye fatigue and the hand fatigue you're going to have if you're using it for hours. So Matt Cashel is our optics guru on Rockslide, and he can, you know, everybody's different with how they like their binos, but you want to go with somebody that knows what they're talking about, definitely.
Yeah,
and they can be a bit subjective. I always tell people, you bring your own lenses to the party, and your lenses are different than mine, and Tanya's are different than yours. So there is a little bit of subjectivity to it.
Tell any of those guys that are, you know, new to hunting, trying to get into gear, I do get a lot of people asking me about gear constantly, mm-hmm. about what lightweight gear, what boots. You know, I get, you know, I have a dozen plus people every year calling me on, you know, these hunters. They want me to pretty much, they'll go through a whole gear list with me. They want to know how far they need to shoot, obviously, on shooting. Uh-huh. The further you can shoot accurately, the better here in the West. But as far as optics, that is something, if you can afford it, go better. What got me into Swarovski, I had a Brunton spotting scope, and I thought it was pretty good. You know, it was a $1,000, $1,100, $1,100 spotting scope at the time. And I'd glass this one area that I glassed many times. I had a friend that had the Swarovski, a different one, you know, but he had the same Swarovski that I wound up buying. He let me borrow it that evening. And I got up on that ridge and I was glassing, and it got to the point where it was starting to get that last layer of, you know, level of darkness where you only have, in my Brunton, I went across and looking at some areas that I, you know, seen game at, and I wound up putting that Swarovski out there. I would have never seen it without it, but I wound up finding the biggest buck I've seen to this day. And wow. He just barely caught him, but I caught him. The difference was the glass, 100%. Mm-hmm. I looked in the Brunton. And once I knew where he was at, I could see him in the Brunton, but mm-hmm. I would not have ever picked him out. That was what sold me right then, because I picked him out because of the spotting scope.
That's what people say, is that last half hour of light, that transmission that you'll get with a lot of these higher end. Yeah. They just don't know if they don't know.
Yeah,
almost everything will work on a bright, sunny day.
So on gear, anything that, like, would you say is your best piece of equipment? Any cost that you take with you every single trip? What's your, like, favorite piece of equipment that people might not realize?
So I've gone through a lot of gear. I'll be wearing rags. You can, Ryan, attest to that. I wear my stuff out. But one thing that I've really enjoyed, and it's been with me everywhere I go, I don't go anywhere without it, is a little Etrex 20 GPS with the Onyx map. And I've had that one since 2012. Well, not that one. I've lost a couple. But but that has worked. To me, that is one of my – I go to that thing often. When I first started to learn to navigate and be in country, Selway, it was always map and compass. And when I went with this, it just has made everything a lot easier as far as not knowing where I'm at, but getting to places quickest in the dark, you know, mm-hmm. picking the right finger to go up on in the dark, you know, from what I do, I have to be where I want to be for scouting. I don't have enough time just to go waste the morning scouting. Mm-hmm. I have to be where I want to be that morning at a certain time. If I go on a scouting package, I'm not going to stay an extra day just to make up for that day I missed. It's very easy to get, you know, get off track, where Zach gives me the quickest route, and it's been instrumental, especially when you get a lot of rolling hills and you want to be at a certain glassing spot that maybe I've identified from either before, or say in Google Earth, I identified a glassing spot I want to be in that morning where I can, maybe it's the only spot I can actually see from. That's been instrumental. And like, just say being on a road and you're driving and you need to, there's no landmarks and it's pure dark and you're kind of in a semi-new area. Maybe you know the area a little bit, but mm-hmm. pure dark, and you need to pick the right ridge to get up, and you got to hike 5 miles up a ridge or 4 miles up a ridge. You want to be on the right spot. You can waste so much time messing with it. You can be a little bit off on a finger and you go up a rock cliff, you know. It's been instrumental in that. Not only that, it shows some of the land ownership and stuff. So it's been a tool that, unlike a internet phone or being able to see a downloaded map, this one always works wherever you're at. You know, have it, so you're good to go.
So you would take that over the phone base on X base map.
It's been more consistent for me, and I love the topo. It shows the topo lines in high detail, and it just being able to see that, mm-hmm. I can see where I want to go. I don't need to have a zoomed in. It's nice to have the. And I'm starting to get a little bit more hip to these, these apps and stuff. But I'm not going to be without that, because that one works wherever I'm at, no matter what. I don't have to worry about it. And then, a few things it offers that even the Onyx maps, or the new map systems, maybe don't show that. Showing your phone is finding little trails that, you know, it'll go into like your high detailed topo maps on that Etrex. I'll be able to find little trails that, you know, walking through a brushy mountain, you know, you're walking down and you're just in nasty brush, and you look on that little map, you know, on your screen there, and you say, oh shoot, 200 yards down this hill there's a trail. And another thing that works good is that there's a arrow on it that I can say how far, I know how far I am from where I need to go. I need to pick it up. I can measure real quick, half mile that way and half mile up that ridge. And kind of gives me a time limit. Okay. I'm running behind. I'm covering this much ground this quick.
And it seems like with the phones, there's always something. Either I forgot to download the map, or the service isn't right. There's something glitchy sometimes with that phone. And people say that's not true, but I've spent a lot of times in the woods, people, and it's constantly an issue that I'm dealing with. And I don't care if it's Onyx or Basemap or whoever. It's something's wrong, and I can't figure out exactly what it is. You know, either it turns off, I didn't download exactly the right map, or there's just a glitch in the software to where that chip and that GPS system is going to work.
Yeah, and I use both of them. You know, they work in conjunction, but that little Etrex is so small. It's not very expensive. You know, one like $169 plus the chip. It'd be cheap. Why not have it with you? And I refer to that more than the phone. So, but you know, it's just kind of I got used to it.
How's the battery life on that?
Well, that's my one complaint, is that I always forget to turn it off. So I'm always dead batteries. So I got to carry a couple extra batteries. It'll last if you used it when you're actually using it. It'll last a week. You know,
so for it takes regular batteries.
Yeah, it takes regular double A's. But if you leave it on for two nights in a row, I mean, it's going to be dead when you need it.
That would make sense. That would be most electronics, I think. I have
the same problem with headlamps.
Yes.
Oh, that me too. They always stay in pocket.
Yeah, and I've been unscrewing them. I like the zebra lights, and I've been unscrewing them lately, and that works really well. But I'm like, even when we were leaving that one day, somebody said, hey, your headlamp's on your backpack. That's me. I leave them on there all the time.
Worst piece of gear, something that you bought that you thought was going to be the bomb, or somebody recommended to you that you're like, this piece of junk is seriously overrated.
Ah, I have to think about that one.
It'd probably be every trekking pole he's ever used.
The trekking poles have been a disappointment. I've broken every one I've had.
Barton makes one now, right?
It's more of a bipod trekking pole. Oh, but, gotcha. Or a tripod trekking pole, but it's stiffer.
You know, I'm not easy on trekking poles.
I got down this hill before him. We're meeting back up, and I look up, and here comes Jim, and he has two of them in his back, and they're both bent different ways.
That's funny.
You're hard on pants too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You beat up on backpacks, even the mighty Kafaru, but they fixed that belt issue.
Yeah, no, that was good. Yeah. That's been a good pack. You know, I've loaded packs down and been able to hold the weight until this one year when I went up there and started hiking. It must have got ruined on my elk hunt packing it out.
And you had the old belt, the old way they tacked it on, and Aaron and Frank figured that part out. They tack it two different places now, but you run that. You like that EMR too?
Yeah, no, I love it.
You packed 158 pounds of my bull out with that sucker. You're a machine.
No, that's a good pack. Those pants, what were those pants called there?
The first ones are the ones you're reviewing for us?
The ones I review.
They're the Kuyu Tallis Hybrid pants.
Yeah, no, those pants, they held up very well, you know, as far as going through some of that brushy country that'll just shred pants.
Yeah, for you, they've held up great. Jim's like a one pants, 1 month kind of a guy.
Yeah, Jim's reviewing that and a couple other things. So
what else
that's
are you
exciting.
Reviewing for Rockside?
I'm excited to read those.
I'm reviewing that. Pick this one on my own. It's the Solo Hunter rifle cover.
Yeah.
That thing is, to me, that's almost, you know, it's a cheap piece of gear. But to me, it's one of my favorite things that I've ever purchased. I do a lot of muzzleloader hunting. I hunt a lot of brush and snow, you know, up here in North Idaho with my rifle. And I've had snow straight up screw me, you know, you get excited to chase tracking a buck or something up in the mountains, and you're going through all that snow dripping out of trees and falling out of trees, and you get like freaking 2 seconds to shoot a freaking monster buck, and you freaking got snow packed in your lenses. Or if you had scope covers and then they fell off going through that brush, you know, or to get ripped apart.
I've had that happen.
I poured pine needles. I poured everything out my barrel, you know. So this thing goes on quick and it covers it well. But what it really worked for me best is the muzzleloader hunting. I do a lot of muzzleloader hunting, and I've had so many times where moisture gets in there, and it just, you know, it's hard to track and be on a game the whole time. You're not thinking about your rifle 100% of the time. I'm going miles, you know. You're going in that rough stuff. You're not just, you know, you gotta protect your rifle, but you want to be able to still do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And this has given me, it has been just easy to remove, completely covers everything. I've had zero issues with it, doesn't hang up. So it's just kind of been a
nice,
really no brainer piece of equipment that everybody should have, really.
What is it called?
It's a Solo Hunter rifle cover.
I was damn glad to see it on the rifle that I let you use for your kids to shoot up.
Yeah. No, once I used that, it was like that doesn't leave. I'm always with that.
So do you have like a gun bearer that you use with your gun, or do you just carry it? How does that work if you have a cover on your gun?
Well, the rifle cover is really light and it's really quick to install and remove. I mean, like a second. And it basically covers the entire rifle. The barrel has a reinforced waterproof and it's real flexible and holds its elasticity really well. But I just use a regular sling underneath that.
Gotcha.
You know, it just wraps around, but the bottom's still exposed there.
Yeah. Okay.
I use the gun bearer. He always bitches that I don't have a sling on my gun.
Yeah.
I don't like to have a gun in my hand all the time. Yeah. I like to use my binoculars.
Gun bearer, man.
I need to get one of those. I haven't used one yet, but
I like it. They're addicting. It works pretty good.
Yeah. First of all, it's in your way, and then you finally just say, no, it's...
Well, it depends on where you attach it, though, I found. Like, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, but I mean, have it, you're like, God, this thing's always in my way, but then you get used to it.
I could use one of those. I think that'll be the next thing I try to get. Carry my rifle in my pack quite a bit when I'm hiking up, because, man, keeping it over your shoulder can be a pain in the freaking butt.
I totally agree with that.
So what about, since you're the hiking machine, what are you using for boots? Are you using a stiff sole or
stiff? Yeah, I'm using the Crispies right now. You know, those are the best boots I've used in quite a while. But what I have weird shaped bunions and just weird shaped feet. Now my feet, I've never found a perfect pair of boots that I've just absolutely loved. You know, but these Crispies are about as close as they've been.
Now, which ones are they? Do you remember?
They are the GTX.
Okay, yeah, that's. I think that's one of the biggest things people struggle with is boots, because everybody's feet are so different that, you know, one person will be like, oh, you got to try these. These are great. And they're expensive, really expensive. So it's not like you can just go and buy five different pairs to try out. So did you feel like those had a pretty easy break-in period?
Yeah, I felt like they broke in pretty easy. Those ones they've held waterproof for me the most. I bought a lot of boots. For some reason, you know, walking a lot of wet terrain, you know, no matter what, you get wet. Yeah, and they have enough stiffness in those boots when I get them that real steep terrain that they hold up well. If it wasn't for that, I'd be wearing tennis shoes wherever I went. But
yeah,
you know, they'll freaking rip out of those things,
right?
That steep stuff.
Aren't you using that, testing that, reviewing that cross trainer thing for Atlas Trainer?
Yeah, no, I'm in the process of reviewing that.
Outdoorsman's.
Yeah, no, I like it. I could get enough weight on there to actually get a workout, whereas I don't, you know, you're trying to use, either you're going to use your really good pack and load it with sandbags or whatever, or weights, and it kind of gets awkward. To me, it works really well, and it's, you know, easy to get your weight on there, and it feels comfortable. It's not, you know, it's, if you're just using a cheap pack to sweat every single day you're walking in it. You know, you don't want to, you know, I don't want to use my best gear for that. And this Atlas trainer is definitely gives you, you know, a leg up on that to have an actual good pack, you know, because it's easy. If you pack your back, you know, your pack wrong, and you can easily get all twisted up, you know, using a cheap pack loaded with 100 pounds. A lot of them don't want to take that, and they'll start ripping pretty quickly. I've ripped through a lot of packs. Used to use stuff called Bayrite, which I use on a drilling rig. It's really heavy. It's twice as much as, like, weighs twice as much as sand, but, man, it'll stress a pack out really quick.
Right.
So I don't know what this is, this Atlas trainer. What are you guys talking about?
It's from Outdoorsman's. You can put a 45-pound, or you can put any kind of bar or dumbbell. What are they, barbell plates?
Yeah.
Barbell plates on it, so you can put a 20-pound plate like the workout plates.
Mm-hmm. Or 45s, a couple of 45s.
Stems comes off the back, and you can put 45s right on it.
So you put it in your pack?
No, it is a backpack with a stem on it.
It has a and it has a little lock that'll lock it in place, just like
so. Just for training purposes, you got to build up your weight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
And I can't stress how important it is to be able to hike around with a pack with weight. Go as heavy as you can go, because you know that's what you're going to be doing come the season. And it kind of sucks to be going all year long without that weight, and then all of a sudden you get out there and packing out of elk 5 or 6 miles, and you got to. For your first time the whole year, it's not a very good feeling. And I'd rather go heavy, you know, up front when you're in a controlled situation, like, you know, walking up a hill or you're going on a treadmill or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least you're in control and you can work your way up, you know.
Yeah, and you're not sweating on your pack and getting all shitty. Yeah,
man, you know, you can wear a pack out, you know, walking, you go for, you know, walk it on it 200 days with it 200 days a year. You're going to wear a pack out. That's why. I like this one. It has a purpose, and that's to carry weight comfortably.
And it
does carry your weight right in the middle of your back, so it doesn't feel, it doesn't sag, you know, like, you know, if you pack your pack wrong, you know.
Sure.
So what is your, on that note, you're a very physically fit guy. What would you tell somebody coming out west to get in shape for hiking in the Rockies?
I would say use any heel you can use. Heels are definitely, you know, hiking heels is a whole different game than just hiking flatland and running. You know, you got guys that say, oh yeah, I want run 5 miles a day. Once you hit that angle, everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hit that angle with weight, because, you know, and just say you only can have access to a treadmill and it has a 12 degree angle. You know, I mean, that's better than nothing,
mm-hmm.
but I would put as much weight as you can, work your way up on weight on your pack, on your back, because you know, when you hit that 30 and 40 degree angle, you know, with a pack that you maybe didn't train with all year, that's when people quit. You know, that's when people lose that motivation to get up to that glassing spot by first light.
Right.
Yeah. Probably out of all my failed people that scout, you know, that I scout for, you know, people that have their fail on their hunts, it's the physical shape. It's being, you know, that's what is the biggest catalyst there.
I don't want to ever give people a fitness tip, because I am not a fitness guy. But the one thing I do notice is it's not day one and two that get you. It's day 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you start to feel that physical fitness level kicking in, or if you don't have it, failing you.
Yeah, and that's where guys that, you know, like me and you, like, even if our butts are kicked, we still want to go, because we love it. It's our passion.
Yeah. But Tanya hates the word mental toughness, but
it is.
You have to want it. You have to want to do
no,
it.
No, I don't hate the word mental toughness. I hate the cliche of mental toughness.
Yeah,
everything
right.
You look at, there's a post like, oh, I'm being mentally tough. If you have to say that you're mentally tough, chances are you probably aren't.
That's a good point.
People that are mentally tough, that's just a way of life to them. It's not like they even think twice about it. It just, that's how they are. I don't know how to, that's my personal feeling about it.
Yeah. No, and I've taken a lot of people with me hunting, and it's been a one-time deal from a lot of them.
Like, I can see why that might be.
You go and almost have to start making excuses why it's that hard. It seems so easy sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but you take them and you can see that it's like they were excited maybe in paper and before on the way.
Yeah.
We get up there, and when their butt starts dragging, they don't have that really want to go see what's up the ridge. Like,
right.
Oh, we have to go up there. Well, that's where the game's at. Well, why? You know, it's like mm-hmm. they don't really want it that bad. You got to be in shape and make it so you can do it easy. But if you don't want it that bad, you're not gonna be successful, especially on your own.
I mean, and we know people that aren't in shape, but they have like dug deep and really, you know, done what they have to do to make it happen. And like I said, they weren't in shape, but they wanted it that bad that they were willing to, you know, really dig in and get it done.
Yeah, no, it's always nice when you go with somebody that really wants it. That's why there's not a lot of people I like to go with. You know, Ryan's one of them. Right. And it's because, you know, he wants to go up there, get up on the mountain. And one thing I notice is like, you know, getting up on a, you know, when you want to go somewhere, when you start wanting to cut corners, and, well, maybe we could just go there instead. It's that's where your hunt's going to fall apart.
Well, I don't ever stay with Jim. I just meet him later because he just blows out the hill. I'm a steady turtle. Jim's more of a rabbit with endurance. I'll get there. So Jim knows. He'll just go up there, and usually it works to my advantage. I don't want to tell him the secret, but I will. But he'll find everything, and then I'll show up, and he'll be like, all right, they're right. All right.
He's already been blasting for an hour, so he knows where everything's at.
Yeah, Jim's a stud. There's no doubt about it. And if you do buy a scouting package through them, you're getting everything and more.
I'm thinking about buying one for him. And then I want him to meet me there after he finds the elk, and then I'm going to have him pack most of it out for me. Do you have a package for that? No?
Okay. A pack out package?
Pack out package.
Technically, that would be against the law.
You'd have to have an outfitting
license. Oh, gotcha.
So if there's one thing you would tell an aspiring Western hunter coming from back east, what would it be?
I'd say get in shape and you know, spend the time behind the, you know, get on your maps and spend the time, you know, going over your area so you know what you're doing. Don't, you know, try to eliminate your time where you're going to be guessing where you're at and looking for spots to, you know, to go when you get there. Mm-hmm. You want to be, everything has to be a mission. It has to kind of be predetermined. Even if you change your spots from day to day, you need to know where you want to be and just not, you know, just being out there and meandering around or driving around and not hunting. Cause there's a big difference between hunting and being in the country. You want to be out there. You want to be prepared as far as where you got your options to get there and you know how to get there.
I have to say that Hunting Tough program on Rockside is really impressive.
Mountain Tough.
Mountain Tough. What did I just say?
Hunting Tough.
Oh, yeah. Mountain Tough. Because what I thought was cool, and I didn't really love the program myself. I'm not really into that kind of stuff, but I liked how they redid their program based on the feedback they got from like people complaining about pain that they were getting from side hilling and stuff like that. So if people want to, you know, come from back east and want to know, like they formulated this program specifically for hiking and hunting, not just to get in shape. And I think there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah, I agree with that. It definitely, and one thing about having something already pre-designed for you that, you know, has been basically tested in the mountains and tested a year later to say, hey, does this kind of conditioning work? And it definitely seems to work.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I never heard of it, but that sounds like a good idea. Cause like you were saying, I could be in, if you're, you could be in the best shape possible, you know, on a treadmill or on a straight trail, you know, but when you start getting on, you always, my first scouting trips of the year, when I start going hard, no matter what, when you get in that steep country, you're trailless and going down a steep mountain or up a steep hillside healing, you're going to get sore at a whole bunch of different areas. And you want to get through that before your actual hunt. Yeah. You want to be already through, you know, you already want to have that kind of down. Cause those things are, you know, the little spots that are kicking your butt, your hips are just all of a sudden sore or something sore, you know, and that's where you start to, you don't want to have to deal with that on your hunt.
No. And I mean, we tried it and I think we'll try it again, but it's like everything has a, like a variation to it. They really have thought of everything, like, you know, for beginners, for moderate paced people. Mm-hmm. And
another thing Jim said about weight and treadmill and stuff is you got to get your feet in shape. Mm-hmm. So your feet have got to see some abuse before you actually get to the mountains. You're not going to like the outcome.
Yeah, especially if you're somebody that's purchased a new set of boots and you get to the, you know, the West and you want to go, you're going to find some spots on those boots.
That are going to find some hot spots. I should say the hot spots are going to find you. You got anything else, Tanya?
Gosh, no, I think I've...
Yeah, we covered a lot. Jim, where do you want to be found? Where do you find you and Scouting Service that you and Robbie have?
Yeah, Robbie has it online. You know, We Scout For You, and that's where we're found at.
And you can find Jim... So they get a hold of Robbie, and Robbie feeds them to you? Is that how it works?
Yep.
Okay. Do you want to be found by yourself social media-wise?
Yeah, I need to probably up my social media a little bit, but...
Well, look for his reviews on Rockside. His name is Jim Carr, obviously, and he's going to start writing for us, and he has a lot to write about. So,
yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
If you like this podcast, you can advertise with us. Get a hold of Tanya Avery at Tanya@avaryadventures.com. And please listen to our sponsors, Mountain Ops at mountainops.com and Bertram Brass at bertramsbrass.com. Thanks for listening, guys.